Welcome you all to today's Clune Internet Seminar, which is part of the OSC Readiness Presents Seminar Series and is entitled Natural Resource Trustees and the Laws They Were Required to Enforce. Today's session has been sponsored by the EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, which is the same group that I'm a part of. And my name, again, is Jean Valance, where I'll be helping to moderate or host today's session. The presentation today basically will provide a general understanding of natural resource federal, state, and tribal resource trustees and their resources. The session is going to provide practical information on the definition of natural resources and examples of resources under federal, state, and tribal trusteeship. Participants are also going to learn about the legal and regulatory basis for EPA's notification and coordination activities with natural resource trustees. I'll introduce our speaker in just a few moments, but before I do that, I want to cover some basic housekeeping items. A reminder for those of you who are joining us today, if you haven't participated in a CLUIN seminar before, CLUIN seminars are similar to conference calls where each participant is expected to have a copy of the presentation materials in front of them, and they'll be verbally guided through the materials at cues from our instructor. So if you haven't done so already, I would encourage you all to open up or download a copy of the presentation materials. When you signed up for today's seminar, you would have been directed to the seminar homepage, which had a complete description of the event, had contact information for our presenter as well as myself, and there were also options to click a button that says go to seminar to join the internet seminar. You can also use the download links to download the seminar slides as either PowerPoints or PDFs at the bottom of that page. I'm going to ask everyone to move past slide number one and on to slide number two, which covers our housekeeping items. Again, we ask everybody who's on the phone lines to mute your lines. You don't want to put the call on hold. There could be background music or commercials that could be disruptive to us. So just simply use your own mute button or simply hit star six to mute your line. You're welcome, though, to take yourself off of mute at any point during the session if you're on the phones by hitting pound six and ask a question or make a comment during the presentation. Our instructor today would be willing or is welcoming the questions as he goes along through the materials. So again, if you have a question or comment, you can take yourself off of mute, but we then would remind you to go right back on to mute after you've asked your question so that there's no disruption. For those of you that are streaming the audio online, you'll be able to type up your comments or questions using one of the buttons that you see along the top of your seminar slides. There's a series of orange icons that appear along the top of those slides. One of them has a single question mark button in there. If you click that, as long as your pop-up blockers have been disabled, a new window will open up where you can type up comments or questions, and I will read them out loud on your behalf to our presenter so that he can answer them. You can also use those icons to move through the materials. Again, if you're looking at the slides online, the single arrow pointing to the right will move you forward one slide. The single arrow pointing to the left will move you backwards one slide. There are numbered links that appear along the left of the slides as well, and you can jump through the slides at verbal cues as well using those links. I want to also remind everybody that today's session is being recorded and will be archived. You will automatically receive an email from me within 1 to 2 weeks as soon as the archive is available that will provide you a link where you can actually download and replay the material. You're welcome to forward this session on to others if you think that they'll find it useful. Another reminder as well is that you can browse the almost 400 recorded sessions that we currently have available for free on CLUIN at the URL shown on slide number two. So again, a reminder, keep the call on mute unless you have a question. You can take yourself off of mute. It's star six to mute, pound six to unmute. You can ask questions at any point in time during today's session. You can type them up and I'll read them out loud. Or again, you can take yourself off of mute and ask them verbally by phone if you prefer. So with that, those are the end of the reminders that I have, and I'm going to ask everyone to transition or move along to slide number three. And I'm going to turn things over to today's presenter, who is Earl Liverman. Earl is an on-scene coordinator from EPA Region 10. Earl, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Jean, and good morning to everyone throughout the country. I, as Jean noted, I'm an FOSC with EPA. I've been with EPA for about 20 years. I'm stationed in North Idaho, and I've had the good pleasure and the challenge of working with natural resource trustees on a number of occasions. And there's actually several people on the conference today whom I've worked with in the past years. As Jean noted, I hope if you have a comment or an experience to share throughout this presentation that you would feel free to chime in and share that with all of us. I think that will go a great distance to making this a successful course, far more than just listening to me for 2 hours. Well, as Jean said by way of introduction, the purpose of this seminar is to define natural resource trustee concept and terms, and to discuss particularly the following topics as they relate to trustees within the broader context of the NCP, and that is the definition of natural resources, who are the natural resource trustees. I know over these past many years I've found that number of trustees are far greater than I certainly appreciated early on, and perhaps for many of you as well. To understand the role of EPA on-scene coordinators and other agency coordinators, to include the United States Coast Guard, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Forest Service where appropriate, their preparedness and response activities with respect to trustees. And on the flip side of that, what is the role of trustees, daring preparedness and response activities when working with on-scene coordinators, and to briefly introduce the concept of natural resource damage assessments and how OSCs can work with the various trustees. At the end of that module, I would also like to spend some time focusing on two particular statutes that we find ourselves dealing with frequently. One is the Endangered Species Act, and in particular Section 7 at the federal level, and then the National Historic Preservation Act, which is one that we routinely deal with at the state and tribal level. And just further by way of background, natural resource injuries may occur at sites as a result of releases of hazardous substances or oil. And although impacts to natural resources may be addressed under other statutory authorities, this seminar is going to focus on provisions under CERCLA, or the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, and OPA, or the Oil Pollution Act. And I would also like to point out one more thing, is at the very end of this presentation, there is a slide that will ask for your feedback. And that's very important to all of us, particularly insofar that this is the first time, I believe, that this seminar has been offered. And there's certainly room for improvement, and I would encourage you to take the few moments to offer any and all suggestions you might have as to how we could make this a better course offering. Okay, if you'll move on to slide 4, please. These are the course objectives that were mentioned early on. In particular, with respect to the first, understand the legal and regulatory basis. Again, I'm going to emphasize the NCP and or I'll provide statutory sites to either CERCLA and OPA. And for those of you who may not be familiar with the acronym NCP, that stands for the National Oil and Hazardous Substances Pollution Contingency Plan, which we will talk about here in a few moments. So in addition to understanding the legal and statutory basis, I hope to provide a general understanding as to what natural resources are, who the trustees are, and what are trust resources, as well as provide some guidance in working with the trustees with respect to the Endangered Species Act and the National Historic Preservation Act. If you would go to the next slide, please. CERCLA provides a comprehensive group of authorities that are focused on one main goal, and that is to address any release or threatened release of hazardous substances, pollutants, or contaminants that could endanger human health and or the environment. The statute also provides authority for the assessment and restoration of natural resources that may have been injured by a hazardous substance release or a response. OPA provides authority for oral pollution liability and compensation, as well as for the federal government to direct and manage oil spill cleanups. Similar to CERCLA, OPA contains authorities to allow for the assessment and restoration of natural resources that have been contaminated by a discharge or threatened discharge of oil. And there is an OSWR directive which is entitled CERCLA Coordination with Natural Resource Trustees. It's Directive 92004.22A. It was published in, I believe, around 1997, if you would like some additional background on what the agency's CERCLA coordination requirements are with for natural resource trustees. Okay, if you would advance to the next slide. Perhaps the first question on your mind is, what are natural resources? And CERCLA and OPA have similar definitions as to what a natural resource is. And it's defined broadly to include land, fish, wildlife, biota, air, water, groundwater, drinking water supplies, and other such resources. Now, what's notable about this definition is that it's referring to an ecosystem, that is, a complex set of relationships among the living resources and their habitat. So please note that it is not singularly focused on living creatures. Both statutes limit natural resources to those resources that are held in trust for the public. And these are often referred to, or perhaps more appropriately, cited as trust resources. Next slide, please. Who are the natural resource trustees? The sites that you see following federal, state, tribal, and other trustees are referring to the NCP and particularly 40 CFR 300. So if at any time you desired to read the actual regulations, you can go to these sites, and therein you'll find a discussion as to whom they are. Again, both CERCLA and OPA identify responsibility for protection of natural resource trustees, and these trustees can be either federal, state, tribal, or other, and other includes federal governments, and we'll speak about that briefly. These individuals are entities, if you will, are trustees because no one individual owns a natural resource. Rather, the resources are held in trust for the public, and the two major areas of resource, of trustee responsibility, largely relate to the assessment of injury to natural resources and the restoration of natural resources that may have been injured or lost due to a release or a discharge. If you'd go to the next slide, please. What I now hope to do is spend some time going through the different types of trustees. First of all, with respect to the federal trustees, those include the Secretaries of Agriculture, Commerce, Defense, Energy, and Interior. And within the Department of Agriculture, the trustees generally include the Forest Service, the Natural Resource Conservation Service, and the Conservation Reserve Program. And the types of lands that fall under this umbrella include federal rangelands, federally managed fisheries, federally owned or managed farmlands, lands enrolled in the Wetlands Reserve Program, and perhaps the most common lands that are a part of the National Forest System. You'll go to the next slide, please. Under the Department of Commerce, typically the Department of Commerce Secretary has delegated the trustee responsibility to either the administrator of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And the following offices or groups within NOAA generally have responsibility for the protection and management of resources that fall under the Department of Commerce, and that includes the National Marine Fisheries Service, the Office of Ocean and Coastal Resource Management, and the Office of Oceanography and Marine Services. There's also instances, though, where there may be co-trustee responsibilities, such as co-trustees that involve both the Department of Commerce and the Department of Interior, for those resources that are found in, for example, coastal waters. And we'll touch upon that topic here in a few slides. If we could move on to the next slide, please. The Department of Defense is also a trustee, and it is a trustee for all lands that are owned by the Air Force, the Navy, the Defense Logistics Agency, DLA. And, you know, typically these types of lands include military bases, such as Fort Lewis, or Air Force installations, McCord or Fairchild, training facilities, research and development facilities, and munition plants. So DOD is also a trustee. Next slide, please. Oops, what happened? The next slide should be the Department of Energy. And the Department of Energy has trustee jurisdiction for those resources that fall under its control. These lands could include national research and development laboratories and other facilities that are operated by the Department of Energy. Next slide, please. There are also lands that fall within the responsibility of the Department of Interior. The different types of agencies or groups that are responsible for these lands include the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, the Bureau of Reclamation, Fish and Wildlife Service, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, Regulation and Enforcement, which is the former Minerals Management Service, the National Park Service, and the U.S. Geological Service. And our survey, excuse me, and you can see that there's a number of types of resources that fall within that scope to include endangered species, marine mammals, migratory birds, national parks and monuments, and tribal resources. Next slide, please. There are also state natural resource trustees. And the office or group that is responsible for state trust resources varies between states. And I've tried to capture some of those differences in showing you the various symbols of the states or groups or departments that are involved with state natural resource trustees throughout the country. So, for example, within the state of Idaho, the governor has chosen to keep that responsibility within the office of the governor. However, in other instances, certain states have created offices, such as New Mexico, the Office of Natural Resources Trustee, and then there are other states that have specific departments to include Louisiana, Iowa, or Pennsylvania. And examples of resources under the trusteeship of individual state officials include state forest lands, state-owned minerals, state parks and monuments, state rare, threatened, and endangered species, as well as state wildlife refuges and fish hatcheries.
Earl, we have a couple of questions that have come in online.
Please.
I'm going to go with the first question coming in from Chicago, and they ask, where does EPA fit into the trustees list?
Excellent question. EPA is not a trustee. If you'll refer back to, let's see, which slide is it? The introductory slide, I believe it's slide number 7. Slide number 7 identifies who the natural resource trustees. And again, they're federal, and that includes the Secretaries of Agriculture, Commerce, Defense, Energy, Interior. They're state, and whichever entity within a state has that responsibility, it's designated by the governor. We're going to talk soon about tribal. So you have tribal trustees and you have other trustees, which are foreign trustees. So to answer you again directly, EPA is not a natural resource trustee.
Okay. The next question comes in from Lakeville, Massachusetts. And they ask for DOD, what about installations that are leased from the state and they're not actually owned?
That's an interesting question. If they are, and I'm speculating, I would assume that the underlying, the responsibility for trust resources would remain with the underlying landowner, whether that be Department of Defense, Department of Energy, and the like. And while there may be some shared responsibility for leased facilities, such as perhaps just a general awareness as to what those resources are. I would suspect that the underlying responsibility lies with whomever the actual landowner is of the property, but I'm not certain about that.
And then we have one more comment coming in, and this one's coming from Twinsburg, Ohio. This is referencing slides number 10 and 11. They say that DOD and DOE can also be PRPs from a natural resource trustee standpoint if they have contributed to the damage of a trust resource.
That's correct. That's my understanding as well.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right. So I believe we're on slide 14. If you could move on to slide 15, please. I'm trying to do that myself. And slide 15 addresses Indian tribes. And Indian tribe trustees can act on behalf of the Indian tribe for natural resources. And those resources would belong to, be managed by, controlled by, or otherwise appertaining to a given tribe, resources that are held in trust for the benefit of the tribe, or resources that may belong to a member of the tribe if such resources are subject to some sort of a trust restriction on alienation, and which is to say to the selling of the tribe, of the land, if you will. And what I've tried to capture here is just the different symbols associated with tribes throughout the country. And examples of tribal lands would include tribal-owned lands, lands that are owned by the tribe itself, ground and surface water resources on tribal lands, and perhaps any other natural resources that might be found on tribal lands. Now, the one other category that there isn't a slide for that I'll explain here momentarily as to why there isn't is that category that's mentioned under OPA, and that is that foreign officials can act on behalf of a foreign government as a natural resource trustee for natural resources that belong to, that are managed by, or that are controlled by a foreign government. Now, I've tried to speak with several people to get an example of where EPA may have dealt with a foreign trustee, and I've been unable to find any examples. However, I suspect that if EPA ever were to encounter such a situation, that it would be involved with one of the regions that are found on the coast, such as the West Coast would be Region 10, and perhaps with the Canadian government, or Region 9, somewhere in the South Pacific, or over on the East Coast in the Caribbean. So please keep that in mind. I hope the walkaway from all of this is that the trustees are many and varied, the resources are many and varied, and it's something that you should keep in mind. And particularly from OSC's perspective, or rather EPA's perspective, when you're dealing with removal and or remedial actions. Now, if you'll advance to the next slide, please, slide 15. Here you'll find a brief mention of co-trusteeship. And the point here is that the trusteeship may not be one entity that's involved with a particular natural resource. Rather, there may be co-trusteeship relationships. You could have federal and state agencies, you could have federal and Indian tribes, or you could have federal, state, and Indian tribes that may be co-trustees for the same natural resource. And I've offered a couple of examples here. One is the Department of Interior and states as co-trustees for migratory birds, and the second is for the Departments of Commerce and Interior that could be co-trustees for certain natural resources, such as sea turtles in water and interior on land, and commerce interior as well. There's a typo. Can anyone offer any other examples, particularly from the tribes, for those people who are here, where they may have had a co-trustee relationship for a particular natural resource?
Again, if you're on the phone line, simply hit #6 or take yourself off of mute.
Yes, this is Julie Campbell with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and we've had a co-trustee relationship with tribes on various fish species, the Fish and Wildlife Service having trusteeship over listed bull trout, and a couple different tribes on different sites also asserting co-trusteeship.
Yeah, good morning, Julie, and thank you. That's not uncommon for the resources in the Pacific Northwest or the inland Northwest that move through large geographic areas such as the Columbia River system or the Pend Oreille, or perhaps large basins that will include not only several tribes but perhaps adjoining states as well. So it just the point being is that it can become very complicated very quickly. All right, if you could move on to the next slide, please, which is slide 17, I believe. Slide 16. And the point of this slide is to illustrate that the NCP, the National Contingency Plan, has very specific provisions as to the relationships that are required between EPA FOSCs, and this includes as well the United States Coast Guard, as well as less to a lesser extent Department of Energy, Department of Agriculture, and Department of Defense. But if you keep in mind predominantly EPA and the Coast Guard, and that is that OSCs must work together with the natural resource trustees, that the trustees must provide timely advice concerning recommended actions, and, you know, frankly, this can be at times be one of the more challenging requirements, because oftentimes EPA moves at a faster pace than trustees are accustomed to dealing with. But I have found over the course of many, many years, in large part based upon a willingness or the opportunities to work together and the willingness of both parties to better understand and appreciate the different statutes, roles, and responsibilities that others enjoys, that this can easily be overcome. And then that trustees must coordinate natural resource damage assessment activities or NRDA activities with response operations. Oftentimes these two activities can overlap, but in some instances they don't necessarily run in parallel and can prove to be a challenge for both parties to manage.
Earl, we have a question that came in from Massachusetts online,
uh-huh.
And this is regarding Indian tribes. And they asked, do they need to be federally recognized before they can be deemed as co-trustees?
Yes, and an excellent question. The tribal trustees have got to be federally recognized tribes. Okay, if we can move to the next slide, please, slide 17. Okay, what are the OSC's responsibilities to trustees during preparedness activities? And I'm distinguishing here between preparedness and response activities because the requirements are somewhat different. First of all, and most people will think of this in the context of area contingency plans, or perhaps GRPs, geographic response plans. But in developing the fish and wildlife and sensitive environments plans for the area contingency plan, or ACP, the OSC should contact all trustees responsible for resources within the area under consideration. And this will typically include Department of Interior, Department of Commerce, through NOAA and other federal land managers in the area, state natural resource agencies, and tribal trustees in the area. So again, the list can be very long depending upon where you're located. And OSC should also obtain concurrence for pre-approval of application of specific countermeasures. These are things that, techniques, if you will, to deal with oil spills, for example, where it may be desirable to burn the oil in situ, to apply some sort of media, if you will, for bioremediation or the use of dispersants. Next slide, please. That's slide 18. Now, with respect to the OSC's responsibilities during response activities, one is to notify all trustees of incidents, and not just federal trustees, but rather all trustees to include state and tribal. And for EPA within Region 10, and I'm fairly certain for all other regions, this is a routine practice that is followed when the phone duty officer or the watch officer that's on call in any given week receives a notice from the National Response Center of an incident, or perhaps through some other state mechanism, that there has been a release or a discharge. The notification typically happens within several minutes, although it may take 15, 30, 45 minutes or an hour, depending upon the activities that the OSC has to go through in order to better understand what is the incident that he or she is now wishing to notify and to coordinate with the trustees about. There is a specific requirement to consult with trustees about protection priorities and methods. I have a site in North Idaho, the Locksaw River, where an oil spill occurred a little over a year ago. And the trustees in this particular instance include the United States Forest Service as well as a nearby tribe. And so in working through the particular issue as to how to deal with this, the consultation occurred back and forth between the different entities. And just one more thing to keep in mind, many agencies have other regulations and requirements such as working with tribes that are also part of this process that perhaps transcends just the trustee role itself for tribes that OSCs and others should keep in mind. The third bullet item here refers to those instances where there may be the opportunity for the OSC to share response resources with trustees. And these resources may include aircraft, vessels, or boom to assist with their involvement incidental to the response or perhaps their own requirements as well, provided that these activities and the use of resources do not interfere with the response action itself. And then there are also the opportunities for federal agencies that are assisting the OSC in a response to an oil spill to be reimbursed through the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund under Section 311 of the Clean Water Act. Okay, can we go to the next slide, please? Slide 19. Now, what are the trustee responsibilities there in preparedness? Well, it's specifically to help with the identification of fish and wildlife sensitive environments and strategies for protecting and treating them for inclusion in the area contingency plan. Within the Pacific Northwest, we have what's referred to as the Northwest Area Contingency Plan, and within that plan is a specific chapter that's devoted to wildlife response plan. And within that chapter or section, if you will, there are a wide variety of topics that the trustees are instrumental in helping to develop. And it includes such things as recovery and rehabilitation units for marine mammals, bird recovery, wildlife reconnaissance activities, structures, different types of statutes, other statutes that might come into play, who the natural resource trustees are and the likes, and whatever agreements there might be. So the trustees are heavily involved with planning from that perspective. And then again, they also are in a position to provide concurrence for the pre-approval of the application of specific measures that might be employed in response to a particular incident. we could go to the next slide, please, slide 20. Now, with respect to response activities, there's similar requirements between OSCs and trustees, and that is to work together to coordinate all response activities with the natural resource trustees, and for discharges of oil to consult with effective trustees, to provide timely advice to trustees on trust resources. And again, depending upon the particular situation that's being dealt with, timely advice may include or may be showing up and providing information within an hour or within several hours or within 30 minutes over the phone and the like. And also, most importantly, to designate a lead administrative trustee so that the OSC and others know that there is a focal point, if you will, for people to get together and to start to address specific issues. Some additional responsibilities during response are to ensure that the natural resource damage assessment activities do not interfere with response operations. And I've never had a situation, whether it be within the Pacific Northwest or during my involvement with the Gulf Coast, where there's ever been an interference. That's not to say there hasn't been challenges with respect to how we may have designed approaches into a certain area, or perhaps choosing different cleanup alternatives, but suffice to say, I've never encountered a situation that we couldn't work through. And I've also been very fortunate in the exchange of information, and that is natural resource trustees coming forward and saying, we've got this information unique to this particular area, here it is, and most importantly, then taking the time with me and others to ensure that we understand the criticality of the information that is being shared with us. Okay, if you could advance to the next slide, please. And these two graphs are but an attempt to summarize both the role of the trustees with respect to EPA, which is on the left, and the efforts that are required with us to coordinate with trustees. So the first one is discovery. And when we find out of something, we notify the trustees and we begin to start a dialogue. The RSE refers to a removal site evaluation. That's when EPA will go out on site and gather additional information related to the site in order to better understand the nature and the extent of contamination. Now, sometimes it's a removal site evaluation, which could include groundwater investigations, surface water investigations, sediment, soil, and the like. Or in other instances, it may be something less, such as a site visit. But the point is to get that information and then to share that with the trustees. Then there's plans and negotiations. Oftentimes, one of the most difficult questions to deal with, particularly with respect to oil, is how clean is clean, and also with respect to hazardous substances. In some instances, there's many and varied cleanup levels, not only at the federal but at the state level. And as you're working with trustees, they can help to bring to your attention not only those human health issues that OSCs typically deal with, but also the ecological issues, and in particular those environmental standards that may be more restrictive than what we're accustomed to dealing with. And then there's also the opportunity to find the overlap so as to coordinate assessments, evaluations, and inspections. In other words, to get them out there early, to see if there isn't that incremental piece of information that could be brought into the scope of some sort of a site assessment that would prevent having to go out there at a later date, and yet another attempt to get data. Then once you have the removal action, it's provide an action memo to the trustees That's EPA's management document that says what the nature and the extent of the problem is and what are those actions that will be taken to address the problem and to provide the opportunity to review and comment on that, those types of documents, and then to complete the removal action itself. And I typically ask for their involvement throughout the conduct of the removal action, because oftentimes we don't know as much as we think we do going into the site. It's always beneficial to have the trustees on site to offer their insight and guidance and to assist with dealing with daily problems that are encountered in cleanup activities. If you'll move to the next slide, please.
We had a question come in from Boston, Massachusetts. And they ask, is coordination statutorily required under CERCLA?
Yes, it is.
And again, is it limited to NPL sites?
Pardon me?
Is it limited to just NPL sites?
No, it's coordination is required for both NPL and non-NPL sites. And I loosely refer to that as removal and remedial. And if you were to go back to slide 20, in particular, the first bullet item, there is the requirement in 40 CFR 135 that not only must the trustees work with OSCs, but also, if you go back to slide, hold on here. On page, on slide 16, the first bullet item, there is a discussion as to what the roles, as the NCP directs federal on-scene coordinators and natural resource trustees to work together. And so it's not discretionary, it's laid out in the NCP, and it applies to both remedial or NPL sites and removal or non-NPL sites.
There was also another question coming in from Portland, Oregon, and they ask, is EPA responsible for mitigating the effects of removal actions on trust resources?
Well, absolutely. And how that comes into play, well, it could happen from many and varied different perspectives. One is that hopefully that attempt to mitigate will occur the moment there is notification made to the trustees that there has been an incident, whether it be a release of hazardous substances or there's been an oil spill. At that point, then, the trustees can begin to identify whether or not there are threatened and endangered species, critical habitat, or other concerns, such as those related to the National Historic Preservation Act, that may be found within the area impacted or potentially impacted by the incident. That type of information will influence what an OSC considers with respect to how to conduct the cleanup action or the remedial action. In other words, we typically have several techniques that are available to us and to conduct a cleanup, and we may choose one of those that has the least impact on a trust resource. But in those instances when we may not be able to do so, there are also provisions that are out there, typically through memorandums of agreement or memorandums of understanding with trustees, that allow for emergency actions to be taken care of. Dealing with the urgency of the situation, and then to come back and to deal with the assessment of the consequences of those actions, things that may be able to be done to mitigate those actions, and then how we might be able to avoid doing the same thing again. And also during the actual cleanup with respect to removal actions, and I suspect remedial as well, there are certain commitments that we make within an action memo that generally fall within the realm of what's referred to as BMPs or best management practices. And those are activities that the agency bring to bear to preserve resources, such as minimizing the footprint of cleanup activities with respect to land disturbance with respect to the removal of vegetation and the like. And then there's also things that we do at the end of cleanup activities, not that don't fall within the realm of restoration, but rather fall within the realm of site stabilization so as to provide for surface water run-on and runoff controls, revegetation, and the like. So, yes, there's things that we can do to mitigate the impact to trust resources, both from the perspective of an operational or cleanup strategies, tactics that may be employed, but also what can be done in order to stabilize the environment so as to enhance its ability to recover from those actions.
Okay, we have two more questions that came in. The first one comes in from Boston, and they ask, to what degree should trustees compromise NRD claims during Superfund remedial claim settlement negotiations, even if the timing prevents NRD claims from being fully evaluated due to negotiation schedules?
Well, if I were a trustee, I would say I'm not going to compromise it at all. And as an OSC, I would expect you to be the zealous advocate on behalf of your role with respect to response activities, as well as all of those other regulations that you're responsible for in your role as a trustee or as a land manager. And how that coordination or consultation is brought about is ensuring that, you know, you do speak with the OSC or others in the command structure, if you will, and make sure that there is a forum for a full and fair airing of your concerns so that they can be considered and dealt with in an appropriate manner considering the scope and scale of the response. So that's my two cents. Don't compromise anything. Get in my face. Make sure I understand your concerns. Make sure that you've felt that you've had the opportunity to express your concerns, but at the same time recognize that the context within which this is playing out is the protection of human health, welfare, and the environment. And there may be situations where we don't always agree, but certainly speak up and make sure your concerns are known.
Okay, and we have one more question that came in from Lakeville, Massachusetts. And they ask, under what scenario do you fold in a PRP that caused the release and is financially able to address removal slash remedial action?
At what point?
Mm-hmm.
Well, arguably as soon as you can. There is a policy within EPA that is referred to as enforcement first. And what we mean by that and what we try to do by that is that when we respond to a release of a hazardous substance or an oil spill, if we haven't already started trying to identify whom the responsible party is, we do so the moment we get on site. And the idea is to fix responsibility not only for paying for, but also for conducting the cleanup to the extent that they're capable of doing so. And that way it preserves federal resources and other resources from having to be spent. In other words, it makes them available for responding to other incidents or releases when there isn't a viable RP. And so we try to bring them on, we try to identify who they are early on, and we try to work with them directly, most often in the context of unified command, because oftentimes the situation is larger than just the RP, the responsible party, but rather because of the location of the incident, there may be multi-jurisdictional issues, or because of the nature of the incident, there may be multi-agency issues that you need to deal with. But the bottom line is we try to identify them early on, make them a part of things, provide oversight while they fund and conduct. But if any time along that spectrum things are not working out, then people will not hesitate to federalize the incident, if you will, which is to say to take responsibility for those actions and to seek cost recovery at the end.
Okay, great. Thank you. Just a reminder, I believe you're on slide number 23, and a time check for you, Earl, it's 1:51 p.m.
Okay. That means get moving. Okay, slide 24. Okay, I'd like to spend a few moments addressing trust activities and emergency response. And this is oftentimes the realm that we deal in, and that is to say the fur is flying. It's in the first couple of hours or days of an incident. And from my perspective, what are the things that you could do? And one is to identify and prioritize those resources that are at risk. That is extraordinarily important for OSCs, because what that does is that then will help us prioritize those initial actions that should be taken to protect trust resources. And it may be related to booming strategies. It may be related to certain strategies incidental to a release that we should take to prevent the release from expanding and the like. But the bottom line is that trustees provide local expertise and up-to-the-date information that is invaluable. The other thing that trustees can do is provide cleanup endpoints from an environmental perspective. In other words, how clean is clean? And that can prove to be particularly challenging in those instances where you may not have a federal cleanup level, and you have to rely on the state. But in some instances, particularly with oil, in a fast water oil spill scenario, you may not be able to recover all of the oil. You may be very fortunate if you can get 3% or 5% or 10% of it. And if the discharge includes a discharge to land, the land may be such that you can recover none of the product that has infiltrated. And so how do you work through those issues of determining how clean is clean? The other thing that trustees are invaluable in is with respect to determining the adequacy of cleanup. Have we done a good enough job? And then with respect to wildlife rehabilitation, the trustees can assist in determining appropriate actions for injured wildlife and with ensuring that wildlife response plans are implemented appropriately. Recall I mentioned the Northwest Area Contingency Plan earlier. Along with that plan, I suspect there's many other different plans that are on the shelves that at some point are taken down and used. And one of the things that's very helpful with the trustees is helping the OSCs to appropriately implement those plans. And then the trustees can also be a point of contact with respect to coordinating with different rehabilitation organizations. And there's been a number of recent incidents where we've become increasingly more aware of the role of volunteers in cleanups and the like. So trustees can be valuable in that capacity as well. If you'll go to the next slide, please, slide 25. There's also, generally when there is a response, what will happen is people will start to speak in terms of incident command or unified command. And incident command, or the incident command system, ICS, is just a structure that is overlaying incidents that provides a sense of, that enables people to understand what the roles and responsibilities are of the participants. Now, ICS could be very small. It could be two or three people, or if the incident is large enough or complicated enough, then what you will find is what's referred to as unified command. And that's where, based upon jurisdictional issues or regulatory issues, you might have three parties together in unified command directing cleanup activities. It could be federal, state, and tribal. It could be federal, state, tribal, responsible party, or any combination of those. And within that structure, there are the five positions in particular where trustees can play out. One is within command, for incidents with significant effect or the potential for significant effect on trust resources such as critical habitat for threatened and endangered species, or affecting lands, if you will, and resources under their jurisdiction, having a trustee in command is invaluable. They could be part of unified command. They could be a technical specialist to the incident commander. They could play out in many and very different roles, but in this capacity, they would help to ensure that information on the resources is made available and used appropriately in the decision-making process. With respect to operations, where trustees can come into play is identifying techniques or tactics, if you will, and also about the implementation of those tactics. So, for example, using the Gulf Coast, the trustees were instrumental in identifying tactics such as using amphibious pieces of equipment to access areas to recover orphaned or abandoned containers. But moreover, they assisted in the identification of specific routes into areas so as to minimize the footprint of the cleanup impact and any potential impact on natural resources. With respect to planning, they can provide information about sensitive resources. Logistics, if trustees have equipment that's available or vehicles that are available, those might be able to be brought in and support the cleanup activities. And then if in finance and administration, if there is a large contingent of trust staff involved in an incident, it's amazing how many agencies do things differently. Having a trustee representative in finance and admin can go a long way to ensuring that people are properly paid and taken care of.
Earl, we have a couple of questions that came in online.
Okay.
We just start with the first one coming in from San Francisco, California. And they ask, does the FOSC have prescripted activities for trustee response so that each task that is needed can be checked off by the FOSC?
That varies between regions and between OSCs. In the area contingency plan or in other planning documents, which might include documents such as standard operating procedures or standard operating guidelines, you may find checklists. You may also find checklists in what's referred to as IMHs, or incident management handbooks that are there to ensure that OSCs and others take into account trustee concerns. So, yes, those types of tools are out there and are available for OSCs and others to use.
The next question is coming in, or comment, I should say, comes in from Twinsburg, Ohio, and this is in reference to slide number 24 and how clean is clean. And they state that a key distinction between CERCLA and NRD is that CERCLA normally uses a risk-based approach to cleanup. The NRD regulations, 43 CFR Part 11, requires trustees to evaluate natural resource damages against, quote, baseline conditions. So, for example, if groundwater is injured, CERCLA might clean up to the MCL, whereas the trustees might look at the loss of trust resources if contamination is above, quote, baseline.
I agree. And that illustrates one of the major differences between the NRD A activity and the CERCLA or OPA cleanup activity. Our levels that we oftentimes implement can be higher than what would otherwise be an acceptable ecological cleanup level, but hopefully through coordination between the OSC and the trustees, those types of issues are identified where possible. They can be addressed, but we all recognize that there are certain statutes and regulations that the trustees have to follow irrespective of their involvement with CERCLA and OPA. And we also understand that the actions of trustees within the context of CERCLA and OPA are oftentimes different or at odds with what the OSC might otherwise be concerned with.
The next question comes from Sacramento, California, and they ask, is there a dispute resolution process outlined in statute, regulation, or other guidance for situations when the FOSC and SOSC or other trustee disagree on activities or decisions related to the response? If not, who makes the final decision and under what authority?
Interesting question. I'm not aware of a dispute resolution process found within the NCP, but there are certain priorities that are laid out in the NCP, and those are first and foremost is the protection of human life. Now, oftentimes you find laid out in memorandums of agreement or memorandums of understanding or in other regulations such as the National Historic Preservation Act, there is a process that the OSC can follow under emergency conditions that allows an OSC to comply as best as they can with the requirements of the statute. But not in all instances can they do so because of the urgency of the situation that they're dealing with. So there is a process to follow, and at the end of that process, typically the person who has said, I don't have to do this or I don't have to do that, has got to account for their reasons why in writing, and that's forward through the appropriate chain of commands. But I would hope that incidental to whatever activity it is, whether it's an emergency response or a different type of removal action that isn't as time critical as might be an emergency response, that there is those opportunities to have a fair airing of what the concerns are and to work together as best as you can. But frankly, in a CERCLA or OPA response, particularly early on when you're trying to get a handle on what's going on, it's the OSC that's in charge. And incumbent upon that OSC is to work with other federal, state, and tribal local agencies in as much as he or she can to the extent practicable. I hope that answers the question. Okay, let's move on to the next slide, please. And I believe that's slide 26, and perhaps this also answers the question that was asked. The trustees have other responsibilities for natural resource damage assessment and restoration, and that is to go out there and assess the extent of injury and determine appropriate ways of restoring and compensating for that injury. That's different than what OSCs do, and there is a process that you go through, trustees go through, that's referred to as the NRDA or NRD process for fulfilling those responsibilities. Now, some of the major concepts that are associated with NRDA is that damages are monetary compensation for injuries residual to response actions. What that means is, as was noted, and as I trust many of you realize, EPA or OSCs clean up to some given standard, or if they can't, they do the best that they can, which is to say there's oftentimes residual contamination, but that contamination is less than an actionable concentration for some constituent. There may yet be an injury associated with that the trustees will try to determine. The damages are compensatory. They're not punitive. Public and responsible parties are involved in the process, and recovered damages are used for restoration. Now, this process, for those of you who may not be familiar, there's, dependent upon whether it's NOAA or Fish and Wildlife, I believe there's either three or four sequential steps or phases, if you will. If I recall, Fish and Wildlife has four. And there is the pre-assessment screen, determine whether an injury has occurred and what is the pathway of exposure, an assessment plan, how will potential damages to the resource be evaluated, assessment implementation, where you go out and you implement the plan, and then post-assessment, the results are the is nothing more than the results of the assessment itself. And then we're nearing the end on this. There are trustee responsibilities, as I briefly mentioned, that are beyond CERCLA and OPA. And that is, you have the responsibility to protect natural resources in ways that are unrelated, perhaps, to CERCLA and OPA. And those laws, whatever they may be, may authorize you to take protective actions with or without the OSC concurrence and to recover those costs from the responsible party. I don't have a lot of experience in dealing with this. Suffice to say that when I have worked with trustees, you know, we're there with an overlap of shared concerns, but at the same time, I'm well aware of the fact that the trustees have their day jobs, so to speak, and the trustees could be land managers, people who on our day-to-day basis deal with the resources. And they've got their own statutes to deal with, and so hopefully OSCs are aware of this and can work within that framework as well. Okay, the last slide that I have with respect to trustees, if you'll move to the next slide, slide 30, is in review. EPA's responsibility is to notify trustees and coordinate activities with trustees as to the best of our abilities to do so. When a natural resource is injured, the trustees' responsibilities largely fall within the arena of assessment and restoration. As an agency, we encourage participation in our cleanup actions and by all affected trustees, and notification and coordination occurs throughout the CERCLA and OPA processes. So if you'll advance to the next slide, I'm asking if there's any questions before we move on to the special topics over the next 50 or so minutes.
Again, if you're on the phone lines, it's #6 to unmute your line.
Okay, it appears not.
Yep. Go ahead, Earl.
Okay, advance to the next slide, and then to slide 33. Now, at any time during this discussion, if I know there's a number of people on the phone with Fish and Wildlife, I would please ask that you chime in and do your best to keep me honest. All right, the Endangered Species Act. As I suspect, most everyone knows the purpose of the act is to protect and recover imperiled species and the ecosystems upon which they depend. Now, just by way of definition, because perhaps for some people some of these words are new, endangered means a species is in danger of extinction throughout all or a significant portion of its range. Threatened means a species is likely to become endangered within the foreseeable future. And critical habitat includes those geographic areas that contain the physical or biological features that are essential to the conservation of the species and that may need some special management or protection. Now, at the current time, there's 1,372 species that are identified as threatened and endangered. I know the list is greater. It's approaching 2,000 if you start to think in terms of international species. The important thing I would like to note here is that T&E species include both vertebrates, which could be amphibians, birds, fishes, mammals, and reptiles, invertebrates, which could be arachnids, clams, corals, crustaceans, insects, snails. And the reason I mention this is that typically when people think of T&E species, they think of the large, warm, fuzzy creatures. It could be the grizzly bear, it could be Canadian lynx, it could be bull trout, and particularly OSCs will oftentimes overlook the smaller, lesser creatures, if you will, to include non-flowering and flowering plants. And as far as critical habitat, it's designated for about 607 of the listed species. If you would go to the next slide, please.
This is Suzanne Dedding with Fish and Wildlife Service in Oklahoma. I would just like to point out that that it's the habitat they depend, that just because there's habitat that is not listed as critical habitat, if there is suitable habitat, that is also something that Fish and Wildlife Service and OSCs would need to consider during response.
Thank you for bringing that up. And, again, I wasn't aware of that. And I'm surprised at the breadth and the diversity of the TNE species. So anything that the trustees can do to help the OSCs appreciate and understand is great. It's a wonderful example of what it means to work together on seemingly even the most simplest of issues. Okay, on slide 34, the role of federal agencies. The authority for implementing and executing the Endangered Species Act is delegated to Interior and within Interior Fish and Wildlife, and within the Department of Commerce, the National Marine Fisheries Service has similar powers for protecting and conserving marine life and the anadromous fish. And I'll tell you very candidly, and unless you're used to working within a particular area, OSCs oftentimes overlook this. And it's also very common for one EPA region to back up another region. It might be in the Rocky Mountain states, it might be in the Gulf Coast states, or it might be all the way over on the East Coast. So don't assume that if you should ever work with an OSC, that OSC is from the area where the incident is occurring. That OSC may be from across the country, and that person may have little, if any, familiarity with ESA issues within a given area. The other thing I would like to note, from my perspective, that the Section 7 consultation begins with a determination as to whether or not any species that is listed or is proposed may be present within the proposed area. And we'll talk about that in a few moments. Because what's important about that is because if the OSC makes that determination that there are no species present, then consultation ends and they're out of there. There isn't arguably even that opportunity for consultation. And how this might happen is if there's an incident, let's say it's in a built-up urban area, or maybe it's even in central Idaho, but it's a small community and the particular incident involves residential properties. The OSC may make the determination right from the get-go that there is nothing and they're going to move on. Now, that differs amongst regions. Some regions require that you nevertheless make contact. All right, let's move to the next slide, please, slide 35. I found this to be a very powerful slide. It's taken from some Fish and Wildlife Service presentations. But the value of this is in helping an OSC and perhaps other trustees appreciate, you know, the issue of trying to determine whether or not there is a need for consultation. In other words, is there an effect? And this shows the continuum of effect that, frankly, a lot of OSCs are in all likelihood not familiar with, from behavioral to sublethal to lethal. And so this is provided for those individuals who may not have an awareness of the spectrum of effects analysis and what it means to experience an effect, and that being the consequence of an exposure and a response. Next slide, please. Also, the effects that an OSC should take into effect are those beneficial effects. That's typically the one that we do, because we say, but for the action occurring, you have the current state of the contaminant problem and nothing would be done. And as a consequence, there is still that possibility for exposure. So there's always that beneficial effect, if you will. Then the direct effect that could happen is that effect that could directly occur on a particular that occurs as a result of the implementation of the action. And then there are also indirect effects, effects that occur could occur at a later time. In other words, I had mentioned earlier that there's oftentimes a component of stabilization, and that stabilization could include seeding as well as plantings. So there you have both a beneficial effect and a direct effect and arguably an indirect effect all rolled into one. And then, of course, there's the interrelated or interdependent actions, the interrelated in that there could be an improvement in surface water quality as a consequence of cleaning up contaminated soils, and the interdependent effect might very well be that as a consequence of the site stabilization activities, if you will, you're providing some measure of habitat improvement that has larger collateral impacts that an OSC will oftentimes think of. And so these are things that we always try to keep in mind as we're considering our obligations, our responsibilities pursuant to Section 7.
This is Suzanne again from Tulsa, and I just wanted to make a comment that when OSCs are considering effects to the endangered species during an oil spill, the OSC is responsible for considering the effects from the response itself, not from the oil spill, and that may seem like kind of hard to, you know, decipher which responses come, which impacts are coming from what. But if there is a consultation that occurs, the EPA is actually supposed to is only responsible for consulting on the response. And that is something important to keep in mind as we're going through this, because EPA didn't spill the oil, but they're in charge of the response. So,
right. And that's an excellent point. And I can give you an example of a cleanup that occurred in Region 10 where that came into play. And that involved an oil spill on one of the major regional highways. There was a release over the embankment and into the adjoining water body. And the OSC at that time removed the embankment and in so doing destroyed that habitat immediately adjacent to the bank. And it caused other problems as well with the land managers with respect to the designation of the river. Well, we learned from that, and in subsequent accidents along the same stretch of road, we've since now recovered the damaged resource, which is large boulders, and we've set those aside, and they've been decontaminated, and they've been put back into the river in consultation with the Forest Service and tribal interests and the like in order to recover the habitat to the best of our abilities. So it is a noteworthy distinction to make, and it is something that many of us are aware of and we try to work with, but not everyone.
We had a comment that came in from Vero Beach, Florida, and they wanted you to note that if the OSC is wrong as to whether or not listed species are present, they may run into issues with their response.
I couldn't agree more. I've made the decision that I've described on one or two instances. In one instance, it was documented in an action memo as to the rationale why. And in other instances, there was informal consultation that resulted in a no effects determination that simply became a memo to the file for the project. But you're absolutely right. There is an element of risk, and it's not something that should be taken lightly. And thank you for noting that. Okay, if we can move to the next slide, which is slide 37. And again, these are all issues largely for the benefit of the OSC and those who may not be as familiar with this as many of the trustees are. And that certainly have influenced decisions that I've made, and that's the proximity of the action to listed species, proximity of the effect to listed species, the timing of the effect, the duration, the type of effect, the frequency, intensity, and the severity of effect. And right now, several of these issues are playing out on a particular site that I'm involved with, and that relates to bull trout and some work that we have to do to clean up the bank of one of the streams in the area. And there are certain windows during which we can work in the water and not have an adverse effect on bull trout. And that's something that is being dealt with through formal consultation and that we are informal consultation, and we will follow the BMPs and the requirements that are otherwise imposed on us by the trustee agencies. These are some of the things that the OSCs will consider. Okay, next slide, please. And the outcome of all of this is simply whether or not there is no effect, that's no consultation, or whether or not there is an effect, but it's not likely to adversely affect, and what some of the consultation requirements might be as a consequence of those decisions. Next slide, please. Consultation, there's both informal and formal, and then there's an emergency. And as I mentioned earlier, the whole process begins with determining whether or not there is a federal nexus, and that is there a federal agency that's involved? If yes, then you start the process with a determination as to whether any species which is listed or proposed for listing as threatened and endangered may be present in the area of the proposed action. Now this has always been interesting for me because the area of the action could be something as small as a footprint that's 100 feet by 100 feet, or the area could be something as large as 23 or 25 linear miles, wherein the action focuses around the road. Or the action may focus around a 2 or 3 acre mine site, but because you have a camp that's set up 5 or 6 miles away, the area becomes, you know, that larger area where you've got the site, you've got your lodging and other accommodations. So the area is very important, and something that the OSC needs to be made aware of and cognizant of as part of their cleanup activities. If no such species are present, then consultation ends. And I've dealt with this, as I said, in some instances, albeit few, myself. In other instances, it's been over the phone and dealing with trustees in the local area to try to make that determination. Typically, what we deal with are emergency and informal consultations. With respect to informal, the may affect but not likely to adversely affect, those are typically associated with what we refer to as time critical. And as a consequence of that, we will put together a biological assessment. And I think the real measure of success in putting together the BA is early on consulting with the trustees so that not only do you have an understanding of the roles and responsibilities of each other, but you have an appreciation for what the nature of the cleanup action is, but also the area in mind. And that as you are developing the documents that are leading to the conduct of the cleanup action, where appropriate, you can also work on the development of a BA such that when the document is submitted to, for example, the service, Fish and Wildlife Service, they've already had the opportunity to be engaged with the project, to offer comment, and hopefully there is no surprises. I've never been in a situation where we've had disagreements and have had to enter into formal consultation. Rather, it's always been within the realm of informal consultation or in the realm of emergency consultation. If you could go to the next slide, please, slide 40. What you have here are a number of schematic diagrams of both the informal, formal, and emergency consultation process. These are taken from the Endangered Species Consultation Handbook that is put together by the service. And what you see illustrated here is, first of all, the informal consultation process. And again, you have to have the federal nexus. Typically, U.S., we ask for a species list. I've always found that when I've asked for one and others have asked for one, what you get is a listing of all species and habitat that may be found within a particular county. And then the next step is to go back and forth and better understand just exactly what is the area that's potentially impacted. Then again, you have to make the determination as to whether or not you're dealing with a major construction activity. And I've never had a situation where I've not dealt with that definition. So you receive the list, and if you're fortunate enough, there's nothing there and consultation is over with and you're out of there. On the other hand, if there is the possibility for a T&E species or habitat to be present, you launch into the biological assessment. I've always found that to be relatively straightforward and very understandable. My experience has been is at the end of the day, it results in a list of BMPs or best management practices, which are those things that the agency can do to ensure that the impacts, if any, are minimal, and then that's it. On the other hand, the other outcome of this is that if you elevate it to a larger level if there's disagreement in whether or not there is a potential for effects, and then that leads to the formal consultation process, which is shown on slide 41. And again, it's a similar process of requesting information, of making determinations, of preparing a biological assessment, of receiving a biological opinion from the agency, or the service, rather. The one that I would like to spend a little bit more time on is the emergency consultation process that is available to an OSC if in the event time is of the utmost importance. And what this does is that it ensures that there at least is that communication, that back and forth between EPA and the appropriate agency when dealing with T&E species or critical habitat and when involved with an emergency response. Typically, emergency consultations are done by telephone or facsimile, or they may even be accomplished on site. For example, after receiving notice of an incident, if it's large enough, it's very common for the trustees to be very close to the incident or to arrive soon thereafter, measured only in a matter of hours. And there you have the opportunity to, the OSC has the opportunity to receive recommendations from the trustees that would minimize the effect of the emergency response on trust resources. And again, this typically occurs, it can occur either over the phone or on the ground. And how this is initiated is, information is provided describing the emergency, a justification is made for the expedited consultation. In other words, there has to be a compelling reason. It needs to be done now, not a week from now or 2 weeks from now, which would arguably allow a more formal process to occur. And then what is also required is that the OSC has got to document, if you will, how the services, the trustees' recommendations were implemented and the results of that implementation in minimizing the effects of the action on the trust resources. So that's largely it in a nutshell. There is that provision for consulting and for receiving timely recommendations from the trustees to avoid or minimize impact to the listed species or critical habitat, documentation of incidental take should that occur, the need to maintain records and the likes. And this is laid out, and in particular an interagency memorandum of agreement regarding oil spill planning lays out the different roles and responsibilities. And it also lays out what's required in terms of post-response activities, the follow-up, if you will, to ensure that the actions are fully documented and that efforts are made to prevent similar incidents from occurring. Would any of the trustees like to comment on that, particularly their experience in perhaps dealing with an emergency response where the OSC has engaged the trustees and that with that immediate need for coordination and information and the likes?
This is Suzanne again in Tulsa, and we've just kind of begun this process of, you know, emergency consultation on a couple different spills. We have a endangered species called American Bearing Beetle that has some interesting life history, dormant periods, active periods, and so it makes it interesting working with, trying to work around some of the life history, but EPA Region 6 has been very helpful. We've kind of evolved into this process of an understanding of what the emergency consultation process is. And I think we have some work to go, but we've had some really good examples of where it has worked out. I think we've been proactive on area inside of species, and hopefully we'll continue working on that process. So.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that, because frankly, in so many instances, the OSCs are very comfortable in dealing with certain things, but when you start to move out and to the realms of ARARs, which are applicable, relevant, and appropriate requirements, are those statutes that they may have to follow. There are provisions within CERCLA that allows OSCs to comply with those requirements under the broad umbrella of considering the exigencies of the circumstance. And, you know, sometimes there's a willingness to avoid those and just to focus on the cleanup at hand. But in other instances, as we become increasingly more aware of the issues at play and the roles and responsibilities of other agencies, it becomes surprising as to how easy it is at times to accommodate your desires. So anything that you can continue to do to share information is a good thing from both agencies' perspectives, as far as I'm concerned.
One suggestion, and I don't know if this is an appropriate time to mention it, but that this training effort, I think, is good. But one thing that we had a problem with is trying to come up with examples where EPA was the action agency, if you would, and only the EPA and not a Coast Guard EPA joint cleanup. So in Oklahoma now we have a few emergency consultations where we would have, you know, written examples of biological opinions on emergency consultation. But I was just wondering if EPA as a agency has gone through and maybe tried to have a database for this type of document to where there'd be some examples that other OSCs could pull from and see how other regions are dealing with the endangered species emergency consultation documents and process. And
you know, go ahead, please.
I was just wondering if that's been discussed anywhere besides my region 6.
You know, I'm not aware of a database that OSCs can access. Generally, this type of information is shared by word of mouth, or it may be shared at various training opportunities. For example, annually the OSCs have what's referred to as readiness training, and there are courses similar to this that are made available during readiness that OSCs can enroll in. So there are those opportunities, but generally it's just by word of mouth. And I suspect one of the easiest things to do would be to recognize that some regions have far more experience than others. I think Region 10 and working with Julie and others in the service, we've certainly become very sensitized to National Marine Fisheries to dealing with these issues. And you might mention among, when you have the opportunities to work with OSCs, say, are there other regions that may have more familiarity with this, such as Region 1 on the East Coast, or Region 10, or Region 8, or Region 9? But no, we don't have a formal database, per se, that I'm aware of.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Let's
there was a question that came in online from Boston, Massachusetts, and they were asking, how would the OSC take into account state-listed species, if not also federally listed, in an emergency response action?
That's a very interesting question. Recall that the responsibility to for EPA to notify OSCs, or rather trustees, is not limited to federal trustees. Rather, OSC must also notify federal, tribal, and to some lesser extent, local trustees if the particular resource at hand is owned by a local entity. And how that typically works for me within Idaho or Washington or Oregon is that through the notification process, we are not only made aware of an incident, but other environmental agencies within the states are made aware of. And I generally work with a point of contact on behalf of a given state who I look at to ensure that other state interests and concerns are brought in. And in some instances, if I have a specific knowledge of a state trustee, then I may even call them themselves. We also have tribal coordinators within the region that we notify as part of the notification procedure, and we rely upon them to identify tribes within an impacted area who may have an interest. So it's incidental to the notification that we receive, as well as internal notification procedures that we have available, as well as through working relationships that we have with different state agencies throughout Region 10 in the country. But most importantly, it is an affirmative responsibility to notify state trustees and tribal along with federal. Okay, if we could go to the next slide, which is slide 43. This is just a brief summary of the responsibilities that EPA has, and that is with respect to ESA Section 7 consultation. We must determine whether there are TNE species or critical habitat within the area and whether they'll be affected by our response. If so, then we need to take those actions that are appropriate in order to mitigate those impacts and the processes that are available for us to do this include informal, formal consultation as well as emergency consultation. Okay, so you'll go to the next slide, 43. There's just some websites there that I consulted in putting to this that have this little presentation together where there's a wealth of information that people could turn to better understand the issue of the Endangered Species Act, and EPA also has websites as well. Okay, if you'll go to the next slide, please. Are there any questions on this particular segment of the seminar? If not, then we're going to move in.
We did have one. There were one question that came in from earlier, and then a comment. I'm just going to start with a comment. This one just mentions that the federal nexus for FWS is not only ESA; it also includes the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and the Bald/Golden Eagle Protection Act.
Excellent comment, and thank you. This discussion focused only on the Endangered Species Act, and it does not include all of those other acts, as you've mentioned. Similar with the National Historic Preservation Act that we'll get into here momentarily, it does not cover such things as the Archaeological Resources Protection Act, the Native American Graves Protection Act, and the like. It only focuses on ESA. But the point is well taken that this is but one statute, one set of regulations, and there are others. And I can say with respect to the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, that's become institutionalized within EPA because I think there's really only two birds out there that it doesn't cover. It's feral pigeons and starlings or something like that, and it's something of a novelty and something that most of us are aware of. Okay. Any other questions, Jean?
Yeah, this one came in. It was in reference to an earlier section, but they wanted to know if the SCAT, S-C-A-T, team process is a good tool to provide a means of consensus among responders on cleanup requirements and standard goals.
Absolutely. It's a beautiful example of how you can go out and conduct shoreline assessment activities that serve both the needs of the OSC as well as the trustees in terms of not only helping to better understand what the nature and the extent of impacts might be, but also where there may be opportunities to find those opportunities to do additional things that you might not otherwise do, particularly with respect to analytical, to avoid the need to come back at some later date to perhaps the same location and collect a sample for a parameter that you simply overlooked the first time you were there.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Okay, moving on to the National Historic Preservation Act. If you'll advance to slide 46, and I think we have about 15 minutes here. So I'm going to move through this somewhat quickly. The important thing to note is that the Act protects historic resources and applies to actions undertaken by the federal government. A federal action, a federal undertaking is just about anything that might occur in whole or in part under the direct or indirect jurisdiction of a federal agency. And this could include such things as a cleanup action, a permit, a license, or some sort of approval. It is the responsibility of the federal government and cannot be delegated absent specific statutory authority to do so. And it's important to note what is a historic property. It's pretty much just about anything. I'm dealing with the site recently where it was determined that a vessel that was older than 50 years old was potentially a historic property. And so it's very broad in its scope. Next slide, please. In dealing with this issue, typically what you have are either state historic preservation officers that administer the program at the state level, or it's tribal historic preservation officers who have the responsibility for preservation of significant historic properties on federally recognized tribal land. Next slide, please. Let's see, this is slide 48. This is just an overview as to what the Section 106 right process is. And similar to referring to Section 7 of the ESA, we refer to Section 106 of the National Historic Preservation Act as to that process that we follow. It begins with initiating the process. You know, that starts with, first of all, determining whether or not there is an undertaking. And if there is an undertaking, the next step is to determine whether or not the activity has the potential to cause effects on historic resources. If EPA, and where this comes to play within EPA is, for example, we oftentimes clean up historic mine sites that have the potential for some historic value because of the nature of the mining process or because of equipment that may have been left on site. There's another site that is a former railroad maintenance and refueling facility that operated from the early 1900s into the mid-70s. And because of its age and other unique features, there is an archaeological component to that. So that's how they come into play. If after having evaluated whether or not there is the potential for a historic property, which includes consultation with the SHPO or the tribal officers, you next determine whether or not any of the resources that might be found on site would be affected by the particular action. And if you do determine that there is that potential, you have to make an assessment of the effects, and then depending upon the outcome of that, you may or may not have to take some type of additional actions. Generally, to go through this process, what is required is some sort of a cultural resource survey. If you'll go to the next slide, please. Now, one thing to add to this, in terms of understanding the historic properties, you need to be very open-minded about this, because these could include such things as a variety of pre-contact features, if you will, such as a petroglyph or some sort of a contact feature, such as a fire hearth or cracked rock concentration. It could be historic maritime properties. It could be submerged properties. It could be historic homestead or agriculture or logging properties. It could be a historic road. It could be a historic lookout. And so the point being is that what these historic features could be are many and varied. And if you have to go the next step, similar to a biological opinion, if you will, assessment, you have to do a survey. A survey typically consists of a literature survey, what's published, what's available, a discussion of what is the environmental and cultural setting. Typically, it includes a field visit, an analysis of the project, proposed project with respect to those features, and then conclusions and recommendations. Those conclusions and recommendations may be there's no effect, or you've got to do one more thing, or something of that nature. Next slide, please. Similar to the ESA, there is a provision for emergency consultation. And what this does is there was an agreement that was reached in 1997 to include EPA, the Coast Guard, and other preservation entities that set up this process. And it provides an alternative process to strictly following the 106 process. We could go to, and it describes what an emergency is, and it's taken so expeditiously. And what that means is an action that may have to be taken within 48, 72, 96 hours, something such as that. It could involve a fire. It could involve any number of things. So it, you truly have to have an emergency. Next slide, please. And what this does is it's a relatively straightforward process that enables the OSC to consult with state and tribal historic preservation officers or offices, as well as with other people, to include landowners, land managers, other trustees, and in so doing to comply with the process. And, you know, how an OSC could do something that could be damaging is there could be actual destruction, damage, or alteration. So, for example, I mentioned a railroad facility earlier. We're actually out there digging the darn thing up, so it's going to be obliterated. There's the isolation of the property or something that will alter its character. Or there is visual, audible impacts. And all of these things could be important depending upon the nature of the incident that you're trying to deal with and the setting of that incident. If you go to the next slide, please. And here are some examples of how there has been an adverse effect. We put barriers on sites. We excavate sites. We establish camps for personnel, storage of construction material, excavating borrow pits for fill materials, building roads. All of these things are the examples of the types of impacts that we could have on a historic site that we try to avoid or to otherwise mitigate as a consequence of going through the 106 or emergency consultation process. Okay, if we could go to the next slide, please. And this is the final slide. But for any questions, OSCs are responsible for ensuring that historic properties are appropriately considered. There are agreements out there that are in place that not everyone knows about that provide for protection of historic properties during emergency response. And if at any point along this continuum a decision is made that cultural resources are not present, then we stop. Now, one thing to add, there's three actions that OSCs typically deal with. There's what's referred to as the emergency response. And there's varying definitions as to what that means, but that generally means that you're on the ground and starting to do things within 24 to 48 hours, a relatively brief amount of time. Think, for example, of an overturned tanker truck or some sort of a fire or crash, an incident such as that. Then there's what's referred to as removal actions. These are those actions where an OSC has more time, less than 6 months, to figure out what to do and to get out on site to do that work. Then there's what's referred to as non-time critical actions, and those are actions where an OSC has more than 6 months to plan and prepare, maybe as long as 12, 18, 24 months. What's important about this is that most OSCs deal with emergency response. Few beyond that deal with time-critical actions, and an even smaller number deal with non-time-critical actions. When you're dealing with a non-time-critical action, and in many instances a time-critical action, there's really no excuse for the OSC not to consider both the National Historic Preservation Act's 106 requirements, but the ESA Section 7 requirements. Where it really gets gnarly is when you're dealing with emergency. And I say this because many OSCs, as a result of limited experience, may be most familiar with or most comfortable with dealing with emergency response actions. And when you're dealing with OSCs in those situations, please keep in mind that they may not have the familiarity and the experience in working with the Section 7 and the 106 processes as might be desirable. And I would ask you in those instances to be aware of that and to really reach out and help the OSCs understand. There's also some new OSCs, and there's going to be even newer ones come on board as many of the older OSCs start to retire here in these next few years. So please keep that in mind. It's not that they don't want to do the right thing or that we all don't want to do the right thing. Rather, it's oftentimes a matter that they just don't have the foundation for understanding or appreciating these other type of issues, because they're focused more on the immediate needs of the protection of human health and the environment. All right, if we could go to the next slide, which is just the website for the council. That's the American Council on Historic Preservation. Again, it's a great site to go to if you have any interest in pursuing this in greater detail. And if you'll go to the next slide, please. Are there any questions at all about any of the subject matter that we covered quickly over these past 2 hours?
Again, if you're on the phone lines, you can unmute your line and you can use #6 if you've muted your line with our commands. I don't see any questions that have come in online either, although I'll wait just a few more seconds to see if we have anybody typing anything up.
Okay, well, for waiting for that, if I could once again make a plug for filling out the questionnaire at the end. It's very important to all of us who are involved with the course. We want to do the best we can, and I'm sure there's opportunities for improvement, and I would be very appreciative of anything and everything you might have, whether it be add this, delete this, spend more time on this, and the likes.
Okay, again, any last calls for questions or comments on the phones? And I don't see anything else coming in online from our streaming participants. And Earl, I take it you don't have any closing statements other than, oh, there we go, we have one that just popped up. This one's coming in from Portland, Oregon, and they ask, is the NHP a part of Trust Resources?
Yes.
Okay, that was an easy one. And again, Earl, if you have any closing statements or comments you'd like to make aside from the plug for the feedback form.
Well, I would just like to say thank you very much. I've always enjoyed the opportunity and working with our colleagues in this field that we're in, and I'm particularly appreciative of having done so with a number of people who are on the phone who I've had the privilege of working with for many years, involved with many activities. So this is truly a group effort, and to know that there's resources out there at the tribal level, at the state level, and with other federal agencies is very comforting. That's all I have. Thank you.
Okay. Well, we actually had one question come in online before I begin the closeout procedure. This will be the last question we'll take online, and then I'll provide instructions if you guys do have follow-up questions or comments, how you can get them to myself or to Earl. But before we close out today, this question is coming in from San Francisco, California, and they ask, can you cover the trustee funding issues with the OSLTF and PRFAs? Again, it was OSLTF and PRFAs.
Okay, so the OSTLF refers to the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund, and PRFA refers to the, Pollution Removal Funding Agreement, if I recall the acronym directly. And the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund, those funding opportunities are limited to oil. And what that means is that OSCs have the opportunity to go to the fund, which is administered by the United States Coast Guard, and receive funding in support of cleanup activities that include only oil. It cannot be mixed with another hazardous substance, pollutant, or contaminant. So that's one means of funding, and OSCs can access that, particularly to reimburse trustees if the OSC specifically requests the trustees' assistance. So, for example, if I'm on an oil spill and I envision the need to have a particular expertise that is held by a resource manager of some sort, and I'm specifically asking for that as opposed to their involvement related to their other statutory authorities, I can request that the fund pay for that type of activity. I also believe that the trustees themselves can go directly to the fund to request funding in support of their NRDA activities, but I'm confident of that, but not certain. With respect to PRFAs, those are the documents that we have available to us to arrange for pass-through of monies, if you will, to an entity to conduct cleanup on behalf of EPA with EPA oversight. So let's say, for example, there is a response. The state is better suited to deal with it because of the availability of resources, familiarity with the site, or something of that nature. Through a PRFA agreement, we can enter into a relationship wherein EPA identifies certain activities that are to be accomplished by the recipient of the PRFA and other requirements of that, and that's another means for funding activities.
Okay, great. Thank you so very much. I appreciate that. So with that, I'm going to ask everyone to move along to the very final slide in the materials you have available today, which is slide number 56, and that's our resources and feedback slide. If you have a print copy in front of you, you're not looking at them electronically or online, these very same links and resources are available at the bottom of the seminar homepage. You'll see buttons on the left for links as well as buttons on the left for feedback. And those links are active now and will continue to be active, so if you have to wait a few days to refer to them, they'll still be there if you've saved your registration email. So the first link on slide number 56 is our additional resources page, where we have a collection of not only today's PowerPoint materials, but also other resources relevant to the topic that we covered today. And the second link that you'll find on slide number 56 is our feedback form, which, as Earl was asking, we do ask you take just a minute or two to fill it out. It does help ensure that we can continue to deliver free online training like this, as well as improve future deliveries. For those of you that are looking for confirmation of your participation today, if you fill out the feedback form, there'll be a box you can check and actually have a confirmation message sent to you by email for your own records. If you shared the line with multiple participants, each person can fill out the feedback form on their own and ask for their own confirmation message sent to their personal email accounts. So each person can maintain a record of their participation independent of the one registration that was used to participate. So with that, if you have any other questions or comments that we didn't have time to address today, again, if you refer back to the seminar homepage, you'll find contact information for both Earl as well as myself. And you are certainly welcome to contact either one of us. If you do email me, I'll be sure to pass your questions and comments on to Earl directly so that he can address them. I want to thank the organizers who helped put this session together, as well as Earl Liverman from EPA Region 10 for taking the time out of his busy schedule to prepare and present today's materials. And I want to thank all of the over 80 participants from around the country who joined us online. I hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time and that you guys will join us on a future Kluwen delivery. With that, I will officially close out today's Kluwen seminar. Thank you all. I hope you guys have a great rest of your day.